Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi. And welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Over the past few months, I've been conducting a series of interviews with authors writing about the violence in Indonesia that began in 1965. So far, I've talked with Jeff Robinson, Kate McGregor, Annie Pullman, and Jess Melvin. Today, I'm completing the short series by talking with Vanessa Heerman. Vanessa earned her PhD from the University of Melbourne, and she is now a lecturer of Indonesian studies at Charles Darwin University in Australia. And she's written a fantastic examination of the way the violence played out in the East Java region of Indonesia. In the book, she looks at the way violence began and continued, but she also offers a wonderful description of the response to the violence by the Communist Party of Indonesia and by individuals who were targeted for imprisonment or murder. It's a new and a different perspective, and one that really supplements the books that we've talked about earlier in this series. So I'm really excited about having a chance to talk with Vanessa about it. Vanessa, welcome, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you, Kelly. It's great to be here.
So Vanessa, we always start these interviews the same way. I wonder if you could say a little bit about yourself and how you came to be interested in the history of Indonesia and teaching about Indonesia.
Okay, well, I was born in Indonesia and I spent all of my primary schooling years in Indonesia in a town called Malang, which is a town high on the hills. It's on a mountain plateau and it's surrounded by about five volcanoes. And I was born there and I grew up there with my extended family. And I suppose I was born at the height of the New Order regime. So in 1973, the regime was consolidating its rule at the time. And I had no idea about the massacres that had happened surrounding my hometown, in my hometown. And my family were took great pains to protect us from what had happened just a few years earlier. So I grew up without knowing anything about the massacres. All I had heard about was how evil the Indonesian Communist Party was. And I grew up on a diet of anti-communist propaganda. My magazines and comic books were filled with images of what the Indonesian Communist Party did to murder the six generals at Lubang Buaya on the outskirts of Jakarta on the 30th of September, 1965. 1965. And I remember I was filled with terror about the Indonesian Communist Party. And one of the things that you used to hear as a child was, don't stay out late outside after the sun goes down because the Gerwani women might kidnap you. And Gerwani was the Indonesian women's movement, and they were a leftist women's organization that was very much demonized by the army after 1965. They were accused of having sexually tortured, mutilated, and killed the generals at Lubang Buaya in Jakarta. So I was brought up with this sense of fear about the PKI and about Gerwani without really knowing what it was about. And heard my family sometimes talk about people who had disappeared, some friends and distant relatives. And whenever we'd ask questions about this, the conversation suddenly closed up. So I never understood why people disappeared or why we couldn't talk about them. So it wasn't until I came to Australia, and I was 11 when I came to Australia, and I was educated in Australia in secondary school. And then I graduated and I was at first year of university, and there was a socialist activist intellectual who is also a scholar of Indonesian studies, Max Lane, who took me aside one day at a conference on activist politics, and he said to me, "What do you know about 1965?" And I told him this classic, perfect New Order regime version of history, that the communists murdered these army generals and the communists were evil and the army took over to restore order in Indonesia. And I was 17 years old. I was at first year university at Melbourne University. And Max was astounded that I didn't know anything about that past. And he said, "Did you know about the killings of leftists after that?" And I denied this to him. I said, "No, nothing like that happened." So for me, it was a huge challenge to overcome years of depoliticization, but also it was a sense of trauma within my own family circles about not talking about that past that I really suffered from as a result of that, because there's a certain historical blindness that was promoted that people were quite willing to take on because of the trauma of what had happened with the violence. So for me, it was a personal journey of trying to uncover what had happened. And when I became involved with trying to support pro-democracy movements in Indonesia from Australia, I became interested because I thought, well, I'm in Australia and I've got more freedom in Australia to say what I want to say compared to some people my own age in Indonesia who wanted to do things but were met with repression. I felt that it was something I could do to support the pro-democracy movements in Indonesia. So I started to go back to that conversation with Max, and I started to think, what would happen if Indonesia did not go through this period of having suffered a huge setback with a loss of a sizable political and social movement that was represented in the Indonesian Communist Party, but also in those mass organisations, and people's willingness in general to question and to criticise. So many of those things were lost with the rise of the army in Indonesia with the New Order regime. And I asked the question, what would happen if those massacres and that suppression had not happened in 1965? What would Indonesia look like today? And why is there still not a strong left movement arising to take the place of the PKI in the 1990s? So out of that, I wanted to discover, what was it that made these events in Indonesia so cataclysmic that it was difficult for Indonesia and for Indonesians to overcome the legacies of 1965? And I suppose for me, it was to conduct this PhD research in the form that it was more to do with my own desire to learn and my curiosity about my own country where I was born, and why the people that I knew, my family and so on, went through that process of pain and of suffering, of trying to forget what had happened to them and other people that they knew. So that the PhD was just a vehicle, I suppose, to be able to do that, to research that past.
So in your book, you rely on a variety of sources, and some of them are archival, but some of them, maybe many of them, are personal interviews. Can you say a little bit about why you chose that approach to learning about this question and some of the opportunities and maybe some of the challenges that pose?
Well, I suppose I wanted to take on oral history as a method and deploy that in my research, partly because I think when I commenced the research, I felt that that was an area of something that had not been addressed before, like the richness of the oral repository that was there in Indonesia, where people had not been free to talk about their activist lives as well as what happened after 1965 to the people who suffered the repression. So that silencing that operated for a long time under the New Order regime, I felt that with 1998, with Reformasi, with the fall of Suharto, that one of the biggest gains of that period was the ability of people to speak. And we know that archives themselves are not objective. So what are collected in the archives also suffer political biases. They push a particular position and they've mould a particular reality. And for me, the voices of Indonesians who were then already, you know, in their 60s, 70s and 80s, it was precious to capture those voices in order to get those voices to challenge the silences in the archives, the distortions in the archives, the New Order regime propaganda that came out, you know, in official papers, in archives, in documents, but also in those kinds of children's comic books that I read as a child. I felt that to humanise the survivors through oral history really went back to those origins of oral history in the 1970s in the West, when you talk about restoring voice and not giving voice, but perhaps reflecting voices that have been marginalised. I felt that the most powerful challenge to that propaganda that had pre-existed for 32 years under the New Order regime was to hear the voices of the people who were deemed to be so dangerous, so as to be silenced for three decades. So it was a deliberate choice on my part to highlight the voices of the survivors, but also being mindful that the Indonesian archives are difficult to access, as well as they're tightly guarded, and it's still a very sensitive issue. So it's really about breaking open this this issue and just, you know, bringing these voices to light in a sort of a cacophony, if you like, of dissent. That's what I wanted to do with my project.
So let's turn to the book in particular, and you spend maybe the first quarter of the book or so in doing a really valuable analysis of the Communist Party of Indonesia, the PKI, in the years running up to the violence. Can you say a little bit about what this party was and how it understood its roles and goals and maybe how it understood its prospects in the early 1960s?
Well, I suppose we need to start a little bit earlier than that, and we need to start with the late 1940s, which is it was a time of the War of Independence against the Dutch. So after the end of the Second World War, the Dutch wanted to return to Indonesia and recolonize Indonesia after the end of the Second World War. And so the Indonesian nationalist movement resisted this, and Sukarno and Hatta declared independence on the 17th of August 1945. But that wasn't the end. That didn't bring about independence, because the Dutch resisted that. And from 1945 to 1949, there was a war of independence to win independence once and for all. So the 1940s were a very formative years for Indonesia coming out of the Japanese occupation. So the Indonesian Communist Party, the PKI, became legal again from October 1945. And so the party had been suppressed and underground since about 1926. Before that. So this is a new party that was just getting used to operating above ground again. However, in 1948, there was an internal skirmish amongst the Republican forces themselves on the Indonesian side, where there were disagreements about how to win independence from the Dutch and what kinds of concessions they ought to be provided to the Dutch. So at the time, the Indonesian Republican side was very much struggling in trying to defeat the Dutch militarily. They were very much outnumbered and outclassed. And so under pressure of the independence movement, there were disagreements within the Indonesian side about how best to win independence. So there was an incident called the Madiun Affair in 1948, where a group of left-wing militias took over the town of Madiun in East Java in protest against the leadership of the army, who they felt was trying to marginalise the left. So this became known as the Madiun Affair, and there were accusations then that the Communist Party was trying to sabotage the fight against the Dutch by raising this issue of Madiun. So Sukarno suppressed the Madiun Affair within only a matter of 2 weeks. And but what you should think about in terms of 1948 and what happened later in 1965, that the suppression of the Madiun Affair was much less grave and much less serious as a setback to the Communist Party. But the Republican forces were split as a result of Madiun. So the left then was accused of trying to sabotage the greater goal of fighting for the Indonesian Republic. So this rift remained within nationalist politics. So some people were imprisoned, leaders of the PKI were killed, were executed, and then the Dutch took advantage of this rift within the Republican forces to attack Indonesia in the second police action of 1948. And so then the left was blamed for weakening the fight for the Republic at this time. So this sort of the rift lingered into the 1950s and impacted on the way the army thought about the communist side, as well as how the Islamic organisations like Nahdlatul Ulama, how they felt about the communist side. Because as part of the retreat by leftist forces from Madiun, there occurred some killings of public servants, of religious leaders in East Java, as they were retreating from being chased by the Republican side under Sukarno. So this created some feeling of antipathy towards the left from the army and the Islamic forces, and this lingered on into the 1950s when Indonesia became independent. So when independence came in December 1949, it was a time of jubilation, of finally the end of very long conflict, not only the Second World War, Japanese occupation, but also this period of fighting against the Dutch. And Indonesia was in a huge crisis because it suffered the effects of the war. There was a lack of investment in infrastructure, in the productive capacity of this young country. There was a lack of technical expertise in the country. So big questions loomed about what do we do with this new nation we've created. And the Communist Party really started out on the back foot because of the events of Madiun. Even though most people had been released from prison by late 1948 when they had to fight the Dutch, so there was a certain rapprochement going on, but at the same time this underlying suspicion remained. So the Communist Party had to rebuild from that period of the aftermath of Madiun. So they elected a new leadership under Chairman Dipa Nusantara Aidit, and in 1951, and he was flanked by two deputies, on one side Muhammad Luqman and on the other side Nyoto. And this is the sort of the triumvirate, the three men who presided over the growth of the Communist Party, which then became a very large, sizable communist movement by the time we have the events of 1965. So it's a story of an incredible growth in this party that in 1948 was really reduced to several thousand into becoming a party of several million by 1965. So the story of how the party grew, particularly in areas, strongholds of the party, namely Central and East Java, are really things that I look at in my book, in the earlier parts of the book, to look at, well, how did the party grow so effectively in that time?
The events, so after the events of the 30th of September in East Java, can you say something about how the army and how the army's allies worked to eliminate or defeat, or whatever the right verb is, the PKI in East Java? Who makes this decision and who are the players and how does this happen?
Okay, so I guess in terms of East Java, where the party's strengths are located, it's largely in the urban areas. So the PKI continued to worry throughout about its lack of influence in the countryside, and it's something that they kept trying to address. We have to think about the peasantry. We have to strengthen the peasant movement in the countryside. So the party grew because of the attractiveness of an organisation that was perceived to be modern, that represented new ideas of how to fulfil independence, the promise of independence. What does an independent Indonesia look like? And it ranged from things like literacy classes to organising women around issues such as bringing up the family, educating your children. And it became like a very integrated mass movement, I suppose, because it reached into households across a range of levels in terms of students, trade union organisations, women's, also intellectuals, university graduates, of which Indonesia still had very few at the time. So the party had effective political influence in a large number of spheres of life in Indonesia and in East Java as well. I mean, East Java was a little bit complex for the PKI, precisely because they didn't dominate politics as effectively as perhaps in Central Java. So in East Java, the Indonesia's largest Islamic organisation, Nahdlatul Ulama, was the highest vote getter in 1955. And the PKI and the PNI, the Indonesian Nationalist Party, then followed. So the PKI had to deal in East Java with a very complex political environment, where in particular areas such as the city of Madiun on the border, the city of Surabaya, the capital, the PKI enjoyed large majorities of support in the urban areas. But it couldn't be complacent because of that unevenness of politics in East Java and the fact that they were relatively weak in the countryside. So when 1965 occurred, the question was, what had happened? A lot of people were not sure what had happened at the time. And this is where the fallacy of the claim that this was premeditated, orchestrated attempt by the Indonesian Communist Party to take over power in Indonesia was quickly exposed, because many of my interviewees were not very clear about what had happened in Jakarta and what were the implications for them. So many people at first didn't hide or didn't go on the run because they felt that they hadn't done anything wrong. They didn't understand that soon the persecution would reach them. So many people remained politically active. They continued to engage in their daily routines and so on. And so the repression in East Java also started relatively slowly when compared to places in like Aceh, for example, partly because of the presence of officers who were loyal to Sukarno, army officers who were loyal to Sukarno in the Brawijaya division. So the Brawijaya division was the army territorial division that was in charge of East Java. So the operations, the violence, didn't start immediately after the 4th of October. The 4th of October was when the bodies of the army men were exhumed from Lubang Buaya, from a well where they'd been disposed. So it didn't immediately begin. And the commander of the army, Basuki Rahmat, at the time was in Jakarta. So there was a bit of slowness in East Java, and it was sort of precipitated by the army officers holding back a little bit and waiting to see what Sukarno's take was on what had happened in Jakarta. So there was no immediate commencement of the violence there. And it was also very localized in terms of where the violence occurred, and depending on the political position of the army officers concerned in each particular locality. So we don't have an immediate sort of commencement of violence across the province, nothing like that whatsoever. So it was it really started slowly in different parts. It started in Kadiri on the 11th of October, where people had a rally in the town square, and then there was a certain assumption that at the end of the rally they would march to the PKI headquarters and they would protest there. And this was the earliest killing that occurred in East Java, was in the town of Kadiri. And we now know, based on oral history interviews, but also writing and research that's been done also by other scholars about how this violence was organised, that there had been several meetings that had taken place in the Kadiri area between leaders of the Nahdlatul Ulama's youth wing, Ansar, together with army officers in the Kadiri area, as well as with the religious leaders in Kadiri, primarily around the Pasantren, the Islamic religious boarding school in that area. So from that we know that there was cooperation going on between the army and groups such as Ansar, the Nahdlatul Ulama's youth wing, that had a paramilitary force called Bansar, or the multi-purpose brigades, Baris Ansar Baguna. And in East Java is distinctive in a way in terms of the participation of civilians in the violence. So civilians were encouraged to participate in the violence, with the idea that if you don't participate in the violence, then you could be the victims of the communists. So there was a mixture of propaganda and incitement to kill using people's own sense of safety and their fears for themselves, as well as an element of force, that people needed to take part in these operations, not only to safeguard themselves and their communities, but also in order to help the army.
So I know we've talked, I know you know Jess Melvin, and Jess writes about Aceh in the two books, or at least in this particular section of your book, the two books deal with the same period and the same issue in different regions. Well, I wonder how your book converses with hers. How would you think about your conclusion in, or maybe I should say, what can we learn about the violence as a whole from comparing the two regions the two of you studied?
Well, firstly, I think with East Java, the mitigating factor that prevented violence from becoming widespread and occurring very rapidly was the presence of those Sukarnoist army officers who, while they were not in favour of the PKI, they had a wait-and-see approach as to how did Sukarno read these events? What is he saying? What is his command to, as the supreme commander of the armed forces, what does he say about what we should do in this instance? And Sukarno was at pains to point out that, you know, please, this is just a ripple in the Indonesian revolution. It's not a big issue. We will get over this. We will manage this. And so there was a bit of a wait-and-see attitude amongst army officers as a result of that. So I guess the existence of, you know, documents to say that, you know, we need to unleash killings against the communists and so on. My interpretation of that would be to ask how, if such documents existed in East Java and there were instructions to the East Java command, how did the officers interpret those documents? Why did they not immediately take action? So there is the role of agency here. In terms of just because the documents tell you to do something, it doesn't mean that that's what people go ahead and do. That people actually find all sorts of reasons and excuses about why they can't operate, they can't act straight away. And I think that that's what the role of, you know, oral history can fill some of those gaps in terms of why did people respond differently to what the archives tell you happened on that day. And so when we look at some of the other documents that exist, such as an anonymous report called Report from East Java by an intelligence officer of the army, you see how uneven the unfolding of the violence was across the province. There was not one uniform response to maybe an order that came from the top. People did not immediately say, oh, Suharto is now in charge, we're going to do what he says. There was a great deal of resistance to this, particularly in East Java, because of the loyalty to Sukarno. And there were also disagreements between different wings of the armed forces about the extent to which they ought to obey the positions dictated by the army at the time under General Suharto. So if you think about East Java, this is the national headquarters of the Marines, and the Marines and the Air Force and the Navy were not necessarily just going to accept the army's interpretation of events in Jakarta, particularly when over time it became evident that the army was intent on seizing power and displacing Sukarno. Then the picture becomes different. It's no longer about the killing of the army leadership. It's about much more than that. It's about an attempted coup over a longer period of time. So I don't believe that there was an immediate seizure of power by the army on the 1st of October, just because a document might exist saying you can now act against the PKI, doesn't mean that that's what people did at the grassroots level and in the regional areas. That's, you know, to me, this is why we need to rely more than on just the archives. We need to see what do people actually do in response to the issuing of a document. And the other thing, Kelly, too, is the what I look at in that particular chapter on the time of killing, the slaughter season in East Java, is also the issue of not just the killings and the suppression, but also on the how the prisons and the detention centres actually then also supplied the people who were killed, the victims of the killing fields. Because I think that's one of the things that we sometimes tend to lose sight of when talking about this massacre in Indonesia, is that there is for a very long time an assumption that Indonesians simply rose up and immediately killed their brethren and in spontaneous mass uprisings, and that this is how we get 500,000 dead. But over time, I find that in my interviews in particular, that people were recounting to me their cellmates, the other detainees, particularly prominent detainees who really stuck in people's minds, how many of them simply disappeared from the prisons and the detention centres. So when we talk about the massacres, often we're also talking about the disappeared. And, you know, for Indonesians to talk about people who've disappeared as having died is an extreme thing to have to acknowledge. So many people still continue to believe that their loved ones have disappeared. And they don't talk about death, even though it's 50 years on now. So when we talk about accounting for these massacres, we've also got to think about that, of not only accounting for those who've been killed and who we have records for, but also the people who've simply disappeared in mass graves after these sort of secret detention centres and so on. And so people are recounting this past orally as a way to keep the names alive, the memories alive about these people, because they may well have been the last people to have seen the disappeared alive in the detention centres. And that's really important to keep that in mind.
No, that's fascinating. One of the advantages that these interviews do is allow you access to a part of this story that I think is often that you can't get to with archives, and that's the experience of the people who are trying to survive the violence. So, see, in the weeks and couple months after this violence begins in the fall of 1965, could you say something about how these individuals who are targeted try to survive?
Yeah, so one of the advantages with a life history approach like what I've done here is you actually get a life trajectory where you get to see that person make sense of those experiences decades on, but they're looking at it as a totality of life experience. So, you know, from the time when they were active to the time when they had to survive the massacres. And I found that people immediately wanted to talk to me about what happened to them after the 1st of October. And I take them back a bit and I say, I want to know more about you before that happened. What were you doing? And often they get very surprised, because a lot of the interviews that have been done since 1998 with the fall of Suharto have always been, tell me about you as a victim after the 1st of October 1965. And they've been categorised in that way. And their experiences as activists have been completely sort of invalidated by the New Order regime, but then also by the people who came afterwards, because they don't know how to make sense of those experiences of activism. So I start with that, and then from there you can actually get a sense of why people responded in the way that they did. So first, why they thought, what have I done? I haven't done anything wrong. Why should I go into hiding? And people did in the end go into hiding, the ones who were not picked up straight away, who were not detained. They did go into hiding because eventually they started to see the spread of the killings to their areas, but also they started to see the way that the detentions, the raids, the seizures of people and property were taking place, not only that it was civilians doing it, but under the authority of the security forces, whether it was the police or the army. So they started to think, well, there's something bigger going on here, something that I can't quite make sense of, that my organisation is unable to explain to me immediately about what is happening, because people do seek information. So one of the interviewees, Pujira Harjo, that I interviewed, who was a unionist at the time, he was in Jakarta and during the events in Jakarta, and he started to think, what's happened here? And he wanted to ask his trade union, SOBSI, which was a left-wing union confederation, he wanted to ask them, what's going on here? What has happened? What is the impact going to be on us? But the office was closed, and he thought, why is the office closed? And he started to get very frightened. He jumped on the train to go back to Surabaya from Jakarta, and he started to see that there were patrols and military checkpoints, and people were the train stopped and the military came and searched for people. So they started to see the increasingly repressive situation and that it wasn't about to go away anytime soon. So the communication lines became disrupted because of what had happened, and people chose to go underground using the local sort of networks that they had, whatever they could salvage. In East Java, the regional committee of East Java tried to maintain some of those communication links from underground. And so This is another thing which I uncover over the course of my research, is that when you think about this sort of cataclysm that occurred that resulted in the killing of 500,000 people, you think that all of society shut down and people turned away. They wanted to save themselves. And we know also in the Second World War that there were the underground networks, people were hiding, Jews and others who were being persecuted. So I draw on some of the insights from Holocaust studies to look at what happened in Indonesia. It was impossible that people could just turn their backs on relatives, on colleagues, on fellow activists who they'd been working with, and to just turn their backs on them and say, sorry, I can't help you. So I try, you know, very carefully to try and work out what happened to people. How did they manage to find support networks? So I identify different forms of escape, where some people escape small towns into Surabaya to seek safety, because Surabaya was a big city, it was easy to become anonymous in Surabaya, or they had family in Surabaya who could protect them, or it was a radical red city who potentially could protect activists there for a period. And there were other people who left their hometowns because they were too well known in those hometowns and they could be attacked and identified and detained. So they went on the run to other towns where they were less well known. And what was remarkable to me was that people used their political networks in order to continue to survive and to be able to gain support. So those very political networks that led to them being persecuted, you would think that people would just simply want to wash their hands of that and leave it behind, completely disassociate themselves from that, and that's it, walk away, expunge your political identity completely. And yet people couldn't do that, A, because that sometimes they were too well known, and B, they could not find any other source of support without relying on those political networks. So you have people hiding in larger cities like Surabaya, in the sort of alleyways of Surabaya where the PKI used to be relatively strong before 1965, and they could hide in those alleyways and those communities until such time as the repression came closer and closer and closer into Surabaya, where there were more and more raids happening in Surabaya, and people were forced to think, well, what are we going to do? We can't stand still. We've got this far. We've survived the pogroms. What do we do now? And they, while they were in hiding, they were sustaining some of their members and their comrades who were in detention. So they were able to go in and send food and other sustenance in prison. So it's a really interesting existence, because they were not completely still. They were trying also to fight back, such as, for example, to consolidate their forces, to say what they're saying about us at Lubang Buaya, that, you know, women were mutilating the generals, cutting off their penises, gouging out their eyes. All this is propaganda. It's all myth. So they tried to fight against some of those falsehoods amongst their own comrades to try and strengthen the forces and to salvage what might be left of the party, because they still don't know how long this repression is going to go on for. Is it going to have a long-lasting impact, or can they recover from this? So their efforts are designed to recover the PKR in as good a position as possible when the repression finally stops. And they also can't foresee in about 65 that the end is going to come for President Sukarno. So there's still a lot of activism at that time to ensure that Sukarno remains in power as much as possible, because the left can see that with Sukarno gone, it would be a very difficult situation for the left. And conversely, with the left gone, Sukarno also lost a massive support base for him. So it was a time of ferment and of activism. So this sort of duality of power that continued to exist after the killing, 66, 67, 68, this is something that's lost, really, from our understandings of the Indonesian massacres because of that thinking that the army took power on the 1st of October 1965 and then it was all over. It's not. We have to think that the construction of the new order took a very long time. People did not just lie down and say, okay, let the army take over. Even amongst the intellectuals, student intellectuals and people who were supportive of, putting a stop to the Indonesian Communist Party's dominance from politics, even they started to question student activists such as Arief Budiman. Later on said, we wanted democracy. We wanted Sukarno to engender more democracy in the Indonesian political system. But we're not sure if we signed up for army rule in Indonesia. They're the sorts of questions that people started to think as 1965 went on and ended. What next? What is to replace this now? And so that's why you have this duality of power, because people did not necessarily accept, and we're talking about the left, but not only the left, sections of the Indonesian Nationalist Party, sections of the armed forces, were not necessarily in favour of an army-dominated regime in Indonesia. So it took some time to win people over by force and by stealth to support the new order. That's why we had a campaign at the time called the New Orderisation of Indonesia, the New Orderisation of East Java. So it was a conscious effort had to be made in order to win support for the new order regime.
So this is maybe for me one of the most valuable parts of your book. And I will say, and you come at this from an Indonesian studies perspective, I came at your book from a genocide studies perspective, and they intersect, but they're not the same. And the mental map I brought with me to your book and to the books of this series of podcasts was Rwanda, where there is this kind of spasm of violence that ends abruptly. And you mentioned World War II. I'm wondering what kind of mental maps you brought in terms of examining the violence in Indonesia. Were there examples you had in mind, or maybe examples that you believe did not fit, or because you came from where you came from, you started fresh?
I did draw insight from, as I mentioned, the Holocaust, also from Rwanda, the work of Scott Strauss, for example, and also Cambodia. Of course, Cambodia being so close to Asia, so close to Indonesia, meant that, it was one of the genocides that you would look at and you would compare, as well as that notion of was it a genocide? And these are some of the debates also that take place in terms of Cambodia. So, and Rwanda, that notion about neighbourhood killings. So people killing each other, killing people in their own neighbourhoods. So I had a look at some of that because it's about, the involvement of civilians. How do you get civilians involved in killing other civilians? And I found that what was interesting to me in terms of Rwanda was that when you compare it with Indonesia, that killing of each other at the local level was very difficult to unleash in the Indonesian case, at least in East Java, because why I say that was as I went on to do more research into it, I found that in some villages it was difficult to get people to kill communists, in inverted commas is a very broad term. And so then the response was by the army was to bring in people from outside into particular villages. So there was a term called drop-dropan, which means that you drop people to particular areas to commit violence. So, and then there was some, I also utilised the oral history collections of the Indonesian Social History Institute in Jakarta. And in the interviews that they had in the town of Jember around that area, you also found that there was deep opposition to the Ansar forces, the Islamic youth group, coming in to pick people up and to conduct raids and things like that. There was resistance from within the village from the PNI, the Indonesian Nationalist Party. They said, no, you're not going to interfere in this village. We will do the screenings. We will do the operations, not you, not people coming from outside. So that, to me, ran a little bit against what the grain of what we see in Rwanda of neighbourhood killings. But in Indonesia, it was not neighbourhood killings in that sense, because there you see the difficulties that people had to kill those that they were in the same village in. And people knew of each other's identities because it was a time of great political mobilization in Indonesia. So you knew who was, from the nationalist side of politics, people who were supported the Islamic organizations like Nahdlatul Ulama, people who were supported the left. Political identity was something that was not hidden in the lead up to 1965. And so why do you have then this reluctance to unleash violence, and you needed that violence to come from outside, to be brought in from outside your village. So, I drew on some of those insights from other settings, definitely. And, the work of Helen Fine about how do you make the killing of a section of people become something that is cost-free. There is no consequences with killing this group of people. How do you get people to start thinking that? How do you then isolate a group in the population to say it's okay to kill these people? You have no obligations to them anymore. So I feel that that much of the sort of military propaganda campaign in the sort of October, November 1965 was instrumental in doing that, in sort of dehumanizing the victims and putting the Indonesian left as being outside of our universal, realm of obligations. So when I interview some perpetrators in East Java, they take certain cues to mean that it had become acceptable to commit violence against the left. And some of those cues came from political leaders, from Nahdlatul Ulama, saying, the Communist Party had done a bad thing. They had tried to overthrow the government of Sukarno, and therefore certain things need to be done to them. Now, often it's not explicitly identified what those certain things were, but then it came to interpretations at the local level of how that might work, and that's where you have the army cooperating with certain Islamic religious leaders in local areas as to how to interpret certain instructions and directives coming from up top. And I emphasise that it's not all Islamic leaders in local areas. So there were others who had disquiet about what was going on and said, to kill another human being is a very serious thing to do. What if the people you are killing are not guilty? How do you justify yourself in a religious sense when you do that? So some of my interviewees also reported that their teachers at the time, their religious teachers, asked them these questions. Maybe it's better that you don't get involved, because what if these people are not guilty and you've done something wrong by killing these people? And so the response at the local level was really quite diverse. And so by doing some of these oral history interviews, it started to become apparent to me, A, how the military tried to convince people to take part in the violence, but B, also the kinds of resistance that, for example, young seminarians were able to mount against somehow trying to, not against, but maybe to divert themselves away from violence, to seek excuses of why they couldn't participate in the violence. So they're the sort of grey areas that, I wanted to bring out in this book in terms of people's responses, that it's not that people spontaneously rose up, but neither were people just forced into the violence, that The role of human agency is really important in how people survived this violence and how they recovered afterwards, because how do you get a society that's been through these events and what do people do afterwards? They were some of the big questions that I wanted to understand.
Yeah. One of the things you talk about here, and that you talk about mostly with survivors or at least victims, is the gender difference of experiencing this assault. So can you talk a little bit about how women and men experienced the violence differently?
Well, clearly, it's all too common in all cases of violence that there are certain gender-specific forms of violence that are carried out against women. It's usually to do with family and children and the concept of honour, of besmirching women's honour, whether it's through rape or other forms of sexual torture that were enacted against women. But it's also about the loss of family members. As primary caregivers, women suffered the loss of children and their menfolk as well in particular. So a lot of the women that I interviewed in my book were separated from their children for a very long time. And not that this doesn't affect men as well, but that estrangement as the primary caregivers led to long-term changes in family life and in the future of their relationships with their children. So sometimes women were forced to give up their children to relatives or to their household servants while they quickly went on the run. And that may well be the last time they see their children until they get out of prison, maybe decades later, or if their families were able to visit, they could see their children. But it's also led to children taking a certain attitude to their parents that was also honed by years of New Order propaganda that, you know, your parents are evil and the reason why you are marginalised and you suffer a great deal of disadvantage and poverty is because of what your parents did. And so some children learn to resent their parents for not being in their lives and also for being marginalised as the son or daughter of a political prisoner. So that's one. And for women also, they, when their men went into prison or went on the run, women also became fair game to the civilian militias and to the army officers, that they became then, if they couldn't find other sources of support, they were made to work for prison guards, for army officers in order to survive. And they may also be subjected to prolonged sexual torture and rape, and they could also be made as the sexual concubines for several months or longer than that by local army officers, local government leaders and so on. And there was also a practice where the women became hostages for the men. So a woman may be detained for a period of time before until their men were arrested. So they became sort of collateral and they would be in prison until their husband or their father or whoever were captured. So the repression affected people in quite in very gendered ways, and also that many women felt unable to speak about that because of the shame and the stigma attached to the kind of treatment that they had, and because of the myth, the Gurwani myth, that these women were licentious, they were promiscuous, this was the nature of communist women. And so that had a huge impact on how leftist women were treated at the point of detention, of being seized from their homes and so on, that the myth, that Gurwani myth about what they had done, became really determined how they were treated. The rumour that all Gurwani women had tattoos on a part of their body somewhere, and so it became an excuse for men who were detaining these women to touch the women's bodies in order to look for the tattoo. So women's bodies became the property of the people who were enacting this violence.
So I'm keeping an eye on the time, and we're just about out. I wonder if you could just briefly for the readers or for the listeners tease the rest of your book by saying briefly, how does the story of the PKI end in East Java?
Well, the final chapters of my book look at the establishment of a rural base in South Blitar, an area of East Java which was relatively isolated. It still is in a way until now, an area where the PKI had been very strong in terms of political and social support there. So they retreated to that base in order to try and rebuild and to experiment with having an underground wing as well as an arm wing and to try and rebuild from there. But really they were no match for the army, and they got in the way of that new orderization of East Java agenda of the army. And they served that purpose very nicely in terms of the army needed to defeat this base roundly in order to send the message that we're here to stay, the new order regime is here to stay, this is how we deal with remnants of the PKI. And so the final two chapters look at this establishment of this base. What did people do there? Were the accusations of the new order regime that this was a fully fledged guerrilla base that needed to be destroyed with incredibly heavy armaments and a large concentration of troops? What was that about? Was that justified? The comparisons with the Viet Cong, etc. at the time, I unpack that a bit more in terms of what were people doing at that base? What were their visions about what they were doing? And then I look at the experience of counterinsurgency of the operation there enacted against that base, the Trisula operation. What was the effect of counterinsurgency on those villages in South Blitar, and how do those effects echo into the present in that area? The creation of monuments, the opening up of roads, of surveillance over the 32 years of the New Order regime. And so that brings nicely, to the contemporary aspect of 1965. How does the past resonate in the present?
So I've asked one version of or another of this question to all of the authors I've talked about in this series. And that is to say, you bring us up to the present. Are you optimistic about the possibility or the pathway to the future for Indonesia and the way it remembers and interacts with these events?
Well, I think, Kelly, the landscape of human rights accountability for 1965, I think it's changed significantly in the last 5 years, because I think many of the survivors have passed on, and that has a certain impact on what is possible to be done for the survivors and the visibility of the issue. When you can see the survivors, you can relate the violence very much to their lives, to the people sitting in front of you. You have their images, you can hear their voices, and a lot of these people have now passed on. So we don't have that anymore. So what do we do in that vacuum where the survivors have gone? And there's that issue. And the other one is, of course, the increasing moral panic in Indonesia that's being fanned around LGBTIQ issues, around human rights, that these are Western constructs that have no place in Indonesia. And, I think that there have been increasing attacks on gatherings to discuss 1965 in Indonesia. And so there's an escalation in terms of a return to that fear, closing up of discussions about this past. So, for example, I've received news that one of the major bookstore chain in Indonesia doesn't plan to stock my book because of what they cite as sensitive content. And this is a time when there are books coming out about, the 1965 genocide and mass killings, and there's a whole flurry of these books. And so in a way, the tide has been opened and it's impossible to put the genie back in the box and to have complete silence and closure about this past. It's not possible anymore. And I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing a response from anti-communist groups, from sections of the army, to say we want to return to the past. You know, we want to warn you of the dangers of communism. And it's replicating very a lot of the themes which I used to hear when I was growing up in Indonesia again. But it's impossible to return to that past now because the genie's out of the bottle and Indonesians are questioning about, well, what is the real history of 1965? So we have, through the sort of the research and writing and the creative works that many people have been doing on 1965, you know, it's been impossible to return to that past. And so while the outlook is not, I think, terribly optimistic in terms of state accountability for this past, I think that it's going to continue the efforts of people to ask questions about 1965, to read about people's experiences, to write about it, to create works of art and to create pieces of theatre and films and so on about 1965 or about how the, not about 1965, but about how 1965 affected people, then I think that is set to continue.
So I'd like to end, well, and this part of the interview with a personal question, and you can answer it in whatever depth you feel comfortable with. You started the interview by talking about the fact that you grew up in an environment, in a community which told you misleading or false stories about the events of 1965. I wonder what your family and friends think of the work you're doing now.
Well, over the course of my research, I found that there were family stories which came out about how 1965 affected my family. My mother was put on an obligation to report to the local military headquarters because she'd been involved in a pro-Sukarno student group at the time. And I, you know, hadn't known this when I was growing up. And because she was an ethnic Chinese woman, they were concerned that something, she might be raped or the family might be extorted and so on. So her boyfriend took her place to report on her behalf for a few months of that. And, you know, my family also ran tobacco drying warehouses in near the town of Jember. And my uncle told me how our family had been asked by the local army operation commander if they could use my family's warehouses as a base for army operations into the plantation areas nearby. And, of course, my family felt they couldn't refuse that request, and they put up with these soldiers who came and went out at night to do operations against the, you know, the plantation worker unionists in the area, you know, and they felt that there was a certain culpability in this. They had somehow facilitated that the committing of violent acts. And so while these stories were recounted, you know, in conversations and so on, when I wanted to do formal interviews, it became very difficult that they weren't necessarily wanting this to be talked about because they felt that it was somehow that they had been complicit in the violence. And so for my family, you know, these little-known family stories continue to resonate for us about, you know, how we were somehow implicated in 1965 and, you know, the remembrances of, you know, the streets strewn with bodies after a night of killings and bodies being left speculatively, you know, as a form of spectacle for people to watch, that when my uncle went on his way to work, he used to go on a horse-drawn cart, and the man driving the cart would say, "Please look away to your left because on the right there was a corpse." And this was, you know, a daily occurrence for them. And we never talked about that. We never talked about that as a family. And it was, you know, when I started to do this research, these stories came surfacing, and it was really painful for people to recall these memories. And so people remember because they want to remember. And the people who don't talk about these things, often they don't want to remember. And, you know, in a way for me, I felt that my family were being forced to remember because of the work that I was doing. So I really am grateful for them, you know, to them for that support and that trust, because it was a dangerous, a risky task for me to be undertaking that research. And they went along and supported me in that, in the ways that they could.
Well, it seems the right place to end the interview. I'll just ask you the final questions I always ask everybody, which is first, what book or documentary or what should our audience who's interested in your work, was there a book or something that was meaningful to you as you were doing your research that you think I or the audience or both should read or watch?
Well, it's a funny thing, Kelly, because remarkably, one of the books that had an impact on me was a book called The Inheritance of Loss by Kiran Desai. And, you know, people ask me, oh, why that book? And I think there was something remarkable in that book about people recovering from instances of political violence and division, where two of the characters in the book, father and son, find each other at the end, and they it's set in India in the foothills of the Himalayas in the north. And the father and son find one another, and they hug each other, and they jump up and down with joy. And this is the part of the book that talks about inheriting loss and how people have to turn away from things sometimes. You know, when you come to a country that's now become dotted with unmarked graves, and yet you have to turn away to get on with your life. And I think that really spoke to me, because I felt that that's what a lot of Indonesians did. You know, when the killings were over, people looked and they saw their country had become dotted with unmarked graves, but they couldn't afford to look, to really look. They had to get on with their lives. They had to survive. They had to do what they can to put that behind them, even though they knew what had happened there. And to me, that is, you know, I inherited a loss, and we all did as Indonesians. And in a certain way, the world inherited a loss with, you know, the loss of the Indonesian progressive movement had a huge effect in the Cold War. And so how do we deal with that loss? Sometimes the only way to deal with it is to look away and to try and get on with your life and to find a better day. And I think that that's what it was, that, you know, because part of me continued to say, why didn't you do something about this? You knew about these horrible murders. Why didn't you stop what was going on? But for me, that book sort of taught me that sometimes people couldn't afford to stop and look, to dig up the graves and to do something for the dead, because they needed to keep going for something else. And I think that, you know, maybe the day has come that we look, we go back to those graves and look at those people who were in those graves and say, who were you? What did you do? What was it that you were trying to do, you know, by joining the left movement or not joining the left movement? How did you become caught up in this? So that's why I called the book Unmarked Graves, because it is about that, about, you know, how the country became dotted with unmarked graves. And maybe it's time that we return to those graves and ask the questions. How did you come to be here? What should we do for you now?
Well, it sounds like a fascinating book, and yours is fascinating as well. So I want to say thank you so much for your time today and for your thoughts. It's a remarkable book, and I recommend to listeners that they go find it. And so I hope that as you continue your research, we'll have a chance to talk again. But thanks for being with us today, Vanessa.
Thank you so much, Kelly. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Vanessa Heerman about her new book, Unmarked Graves, Death and Survival in the Anti-Communist Violence in East Java,
Indonesia. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or Stitcher or other podcast providers, or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join me next time when I'll talk with Adam Jones and John Cox about their new textbooks about genocide. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.